Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello, and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this edition, Professor Jeremy Black discusses with The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, France's historical inheritance from secularism and philosophy to elitism and expectations of the power of state.
Professor Jeremy Black, when we think about the long view of French history, that there is an obvious subdivision we can place French history into. The French history where there is a monarch and the French history where it is a republic. Is that the wrong way to subdivide French history? Should we rather be looking at the continuities between these two forms of government?
Well, there certainly are continuities. I mean, you might argue there is a monarch at the present moment and that the presidency in the Fifth Republic is a form of monarchy. But separate to that, if we just turn aside from the process of governance, I suppose if you were looking at discontinuities or continuities in French history, I might start by looking at the second half of the 19th century as the principal discontinuity, not because of the Third Republic, but because of gathering urbanisation and industrialisation, and also the more overt challenge to the position of the Catholic Church. So I would have argued that those are more significant factors, or that's what I would personally suggest at any rate.
Well, let's start with those two factors. I mean, one thing that marks out France quite distinctively from other comparable European countries is its early level of secularism. How has that really shaped France, and you know, to what extent was the secularism a revolutionary moment in the end of the 18th century, or actually, if we look more clearly, has there always been a strong anti-clerical tradition in which secularism is the most extreme expression?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, any religious system always carries within it anti-clericalism. But I wouldn't so much focus on the 1790s and the revolutionary regime's explicit and total break with Christianity. I would, because in practical terms, that didn't enjoy widespread support, and I think it's fair to say that the early 19th century, as in Italy and Germany, sees partly in reaction to the revolution, partly in reaction to Napoleon, sees quite a Catholic impulse, if you like. What I would maybe probe a bit more is the relationship between the social changes attendant on what we were mentioning a few minutes ago, urbanisation, industrialisation in particular. Those aren't the only ones. I mean, greater literacy is another one, and we could go on. And those and attitudes towards religion. Now, I've got to be careful here. They don't stop religious affinity and loyalty for a second. There are many French people who remain very devout, and that continues to be the case. But I think it's fair to say that the disruptive qualities or character of the changes we're talking about, as indeed in Britain, I think it's fair to say, whilst it might leave people individually devout, does not necessarily mean that they take a view of religion that it should be defining what you might in jargon terms call the public space. And to that extent, we're moving into modern times. I mean, religion itself is not just one measure. There are, if you just look at Christianity, there are a whole host of ways of thinking about the relationship between people's views and their religious intentions or understanding. So, for example, a providential view of Christianity, or indeed of any other religion, that if somebody is bad, whatever bad means in this context, but usually it means defying the edicts of the religion, that they immediately or very quickly received themselves a divine, as it were, or providential judgment. That's a form of Christianity, but it's a different form, for example, to a more diffuse idea of sin and redemption, which tends to be more of the pattern in European Christianity at the present moment.
And the alongside religious belief, of course, has been the long and proud history of the great French philosophers. How has it been that France has developed such a long and distinguished tradition in that respect? Is it something to do with the schooling or education system, the universities in 18th century? Where did these trains of thought come from?
I mean, first of all, disproportionately, if you think of philosophers as spread, I'm not sure one should, as a ratio of the percent of the population, you would assume France would have a number of philosophers in the 18th century because it's the most populous state west of Russia. Mm-hmm. It's got roughly 30 million people by the end of the century, and nobody else in Europe is anywhere close to that. Secondly, I'm not sure I would always say that France is as distinguished in philosophers in comparative terms as the French might think. I mean, there are French philosophers in the 19th century, but they are not as paradigm-defining as some of those elsewhere in other countries, both Germany and indeed Britain. You can think of J.S. Mill, for example. So I think one has to be careful, and also, I don't wish to be rude, but why not, many of the French philosophers, so-called, of the last 60 years are, you know, people like Sartre, are really poseurs, mm-hmm. rather than people who had particularly profound ideas. So I'm not sure I would agree with you. I'm not trying to be difficult. I think there is clearly a character that you would associate, without assuming that there is some zeitgeist, and I'm very wary of zeitgeists, but there is a character you might associate with French Christian culture in the 18th century, which is different to that of Spanish or Neapolitan or Portuguese Christian culture, but that's not the same thing as saying either that the latter lacked profundity or indeed philosophical insight. Naples itself was quite a major intellectual centre, but it also means you mustn't imagine that the French are defined by Voltaire, Montesquieu, Rousseau, and so on. And one never knows as one gets older whether this might be one of the very last podcasts. I don't want to be gloomy or melodramatic, but you never know that. I would underline something that I have always thought in my scholarly endeavours, that there is a major contradiction between those people who judge the past, and I would argue the present as well, in terms of some supposed set of beliefs that are normative in that period, spirit of the age or zeitgeist is the Germanic equivalent, and those people who are much more prepared to accept the indeterminate, granular, sometimes inchoate, but I would say diverse, vital and vibrant nature of a much more dynamic culture. And I would suggest the latter is something that you gain a better understanding from if you look at archival sources. I am singularly unimpressed by much of the scholarship that passes for the subject of political thought, because it tends to rely on textual exegesis of a highly selective group of writers. By the very nature of things, people who write theoretical works are highly selective anyway, and does not deal with the wider notions of political thought, political practice, social thought, social practice across society as a whole. So I'm afraid to say I would be very wary of an interpretation of the French as being, shall we say, more philosophical than, than let's say the British. I think that's more in the nature of I'm not saying that you're taking this view, but more because I know you're just posing these things by way of having a discussion. But I would say that's more in the nature of a rather simplistic account which one might imagine one would have got of people producing rather crude national stereotypes, i.e. most of the people that write most of the time. But that's not my fault. I'm not answerable for the failings of my profession.
Indeed you're not. And talking about your academic profession, what can we say about the nature of French universities, particularly from the Renaissance onwards, the sort of education one would get at a French university? Well, a number of points. How hierarchical were they? Were we talking the...
I remember I was fortunate enough to three times be invited to conferences in Meersburg on the Bodensee on newspaper history. So I was the Brit representative, and it was a sort of jamboree and quite pleasant. There was a Frenchman there called Kintz, and from Alsace, and he was at Mulhouse. And, I had a conversation with him the first time we met, and I was asking what Mulhouse was like, because I hadn't yet been there, and he was telling me it was a total dump and an awful place. And then, some years later, I went to a conference at Strasbourg, and there he was, and he had been metamorphosized into this better position. And I asked him, what had happened, and, congratulated him, and he said, the long arm of the state. Even the French have this phrase, the long arm exercising influence. Mm-hmm. And I remember at that very same conference, somebody who was had moved from Toulouse to Paris saying the same thing. So if you want to know about, there are distinguished French academics, and I've been fortunate enough to meet some. I've sat on what the French call juries, that are, in other words, when you're examining doctorates in places like Aix and Sciences Po and the Sorbonne, and I've met very distinguished and interesting people. But I think it's also fair to say that the political politicking of that to do with appointments is very significant in France, and indeed more generally so in many other continental countries. Academics will privately say to you, oh yes, I'm in this university, I've got a job here, because let's say they're talking in Austria, they'll describe themselves as either red or black, depending upon their political alignment, and so on and so forth. So I think you've got to be aware that people might tell, it's actually hilarious to read the rubbish that often passes muster for historiography or political thought, because it often presents people as abstract exponents of some particular philosophy of history, when the reality is it's which political movement they aligned with and whom was their patron.
When we think about institutions in France, those of us aren't French, or quickly align upon the École Nationale d'Administration, the énarques who come from it. Well, how old is this? Is this form of a kind of super bureaucratic elite? And did it have predecessors in previous institutions which have fallen by the wayside?
Rooted in a sort of mercantilist notion of French governance, and the role of expertise and the role of agents of the state. So you could look at, for example, Richelieu, you could look at Colbert, you could look at Napoleon, etc. I think it's fair to say that you probably should really be focusing on the period of continuity after World War II, because although there are earlier iterations, all of which are different, and each of those individuals I mentioned had a different notion of expertise and a different notion of what supervision meant. But if you're asking the question about the difference to Britain, I suppose what you could say is that Oxford and Cambridge, as traditionally conceived, had a more significant role for the training of the clergy, and you could, in what was a state church, the Church of England, and you could also say that they were, in practical terms, private institutions and were sort of, to many, many extent, sort of finishing schools for the elite. I think it's fair to say say that the universities do not play that same and significant role in, shall we say, mid-19th century or indeed late 18th century French culture. I think it's fair to say that the idea of non-university institutions, and when you're talking about the Grand École, you're talking about non-university ones, just as when you're talking about the French government's central control over research, you're talking about a non-university context. And it may well be that we end up feeling, I mean, I don't know, I mean, there's so much vested, in, not least in social conceit and debt in the British university system, but it may well be that people end up thinking that it's not the most viable way to run a system and that we need to rethink it over the next 50 years. Whether people are capable of doing that, I simply don't know. But the French system is not one that is dominated by universities to the same extent.
Well, another route for young people to go down has obviously been the military academy. I wonder whether the kind of military grandeur of both the Bourbon and Napoleonic periods has created a parallel level of institution, maybe comparable to what the Royal Navy used to be in Britain 150 years ago, and whether that still has resonance today. Is the military academy in the 20th century, let alone in this one, still really one of the key pillars of post-école training for middle class people as well as the more general populace?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, French military education is very good, but I would not say that. I mean, the sort of practice that you might get in, say, Singapore, where you move seamlessly almost from a system of national conscription to rise in the military and then move into significant roles in business or governance is not the the French practice. And if I might loop back to your earlier remark about the prestige of the military after the Bourbon and Napoleonic period. What I might say is slightly different to that. I might say, I mean, one's got to be cautious here, but I might say that what you really have in the 19th and early 20th century as a result of the legacy of some of the things we've talked about in previous programmes is a fractured elite. Remember, many people could look back on family members who had been murdered, guillotined, expropriated, driven into exile, whatever, between 1789 and 1871 in successive iterations of political chaos. And that, I think, meant a degree of divisiveness, which I think you could see very much again. Now you can decide how much at the elite level you want to draw connections, but you can see it very much again in the 30s and 40s. And again, you could debate how far that leads to the present day situation. I mean, continuity is always things you have to handle with care. Just because you can see a continuity doesn't mean, you know, you've got to contextualize it alongside the discontinuities. Again, most people won't do that, but then most people don't handle history very well. But I would argue that if you contrast it with the British situation, clearly there were significant political divides between within the political system, shall we say, in the early 19th century. But after the suppression of Jacobitism in the mid-18th century, there's really, particularly in England, but actually also in Scotland, a process of essentially peaceful politics. Yes, you get some people who are politically marginal. Whether we think that's a good or a bad idea, it's not my place to put modern readings onto the past. But, you know, you've obviously got Luddites or Chartists, but quite frankly, at the level of the elite is much more integrated. And I think that then means that institutions such as the army, or indeed the church, you can consider promotion in information is linked to personal factionalism rather than necessarily political ideological factionalism. And I think that is significant. And, you know, when I'm talking about France here, I'm afraid to say one has to also note that one of the consequences of French imperialism under the revolutionaries and then under Napoleon is that many other areas, principally what we would call Italy, the Low Countries, Germany and Spain, were affected by the enormous disruptiveness and indeed sort of the comparable processes you see to World War II, those people who were allied with the new occupier and adopted what appeared to be their values and shared in their looting of everything, and those people who didn't. And I think that that divisiveness is one that fortunately we haven't had, and it means we're not always well suited to understand the particular divisive nature of dynamics in continental countries.
Following really on from that, I wonder about, you know, the effect of revolution, but also different inheritance laws on the countryside, on the ownership of the landed estates and their subdivision. Is that something which kind of broke down a very coherent landed elite wedded to their land rather than something that is shifting with new money? So is it different to the British landed experience?
Well, clearly, again, it's a question of which level of society we're looking at. But I myself would argue that first of all, there are still parts of France where the old elite is there, landowning families. It's a much larger country than England, as you appreciate, where you can still find people in their chateaus who've been there, shall we say, for 150 years. In other words, they made their money sometime in the 19th century, bought land and established themselves, some of them considerably earlier than that. But what I would say is that the social changes to do with industrialization were more significant, and linked to that, the Great Agricultural Depression, the free trade, the agricultural products coming in from the New World, which hit either domestic markets or the opportunities to export within Europe. Now, to many respects, I mean, there are many other logics for it, and I'm not trying to simplify matters, but in many respects, the common agricultural policy, of which the biggest exporter within that is France, represents France regaining a dominance of European agricultural markets that it, in a sense, was hit hard by in the 19th century, when people are taking their, mutton or lamb or beef or grain from Australasia, Argentina and North America. And that actually helps to explain the enormous anger in some French agricultural interests when, of course, Spain was admitted into the European community, because, of course, Spain was another prime agricultural exporter. So I think those changes have been more significant than inheritance rules myself. But that would be, I think you should always look at economic dynamics. And again, who knows where we are in career terms, in terms of life. I mean, I'm not a man of the left. I don't think anybody would ever think I was. But one of the things that I find truly dismaying is that when I was young, when I, grew up to maturity, I hope, as an academic, you could rely on good, solid, interesting work coming out of left-wing academics on the social implications of economic change, whether it was Marxist or, much more interesting in many senses, Marxisant. Now you can't. They write drivel about identity and gender and race and such like, and they know absolutely bugger all, or deliberately want to know nothing about inconvenient social and economic questions. So I think that's unfortunate, because I do think that economics is important. Where I depart from a Marxist is that obviously I don't believe that it's a determining factor, but I do think it's a very important factor.
Mm, well, Well, talking about economics and Marxism, and let's bring in labour movements as well, it makes me think of the Industrial Revolution. Now, Industrial Revolution, as we all agree, is a slippery term. There have been many industrial revolutions throughout the centuries. But thinking of the sort of industrial revolution that Britain had in the late 18th century onwards, France was a good bit later than that. Is there any plausible reason for why France didn't lead as a European industrial nation?
I mean, there's a whole host of those. Proximity to the sea, very close and important coal reserves, proper laws of contracts, political stability. All of these are, I think, significant, and we could go on and on and on. And I would happily do so if you invited me onto a programme to discuss it. So, in part, if you're looking at other countries, it's the absence of those, and I think that's significant. But in part also, I think that there are systemic problems in France itself. It is politically unstable until the 1870s, and you might say really until the 1880s. That is, I think, very significant indeed. It doesn't mean that there aren't attempts in the meantime, classically. Napoleon III and railway construction. There are, and indeed going right the way back, I mean, we've already mentioned Colbert under Louis XIV, building the Canal du Midi, which you can still see, building for, or encouraging the production of textiles in places like Abbeville. There was industry, but there wasn't the, a lot of it was the kind of industrial process you see with authoritarian governments today. In other words, instead of working with the capitalist system and ensuring the effective distribution of investment and accepting that some areas are better for some areas, for some production than others, there was a lot of, Napoleon the First was a classic example of this, there was a lot of, this is what we are going to do, irrespective of whether there was much economic sense behind it. And that kind of triumph of the will principle, which is classically the authoritarian practice towards economics, and which absolutely characterized Napoleon the First, often leads you to in very poor directions. But there are other factors as well. I mean, French agriculture remained an area which was still worth investing in. France didn't have so dynamic a global trading system as Britain did. So that, there are a host of other factors that you could look at. Fact that French coal production is largely restricted to geographically marginal areas in the Nord and the East, but particularly the Nord, these are all problems. If you want to have coal, the actual cost of moving coal to translate it to, as it were, fire up production in some place like Paris or Angoulême or whatever.
The long tradition of French protectionism, when does that break down? I mean, there's famously the Cobden and Chevalier Treaty in, correct me, 1860.
1860.
Yes. How significant really was that? Is that when you can say France became a free trading nation in the way that we talk it between the 1820s and the 1840s, Britain became a free trading nation? Or is it wrong really to ever talk of France in those terms?
Well, I certainly think what we might call liberal bourgeois groups, many of whom are pro-free trade, are particularly influential in 19th century France. I would say Guizot onwards, so sort of mid-19th, so 1840s onwards. It's interesting that you get an example of that, the abolition of slavery, of course, in 1848, classic liberal bourgeois movement, which again comes at that particular political moment. But I think it's fair to say that ideas have less of a purchase in a kind of politics that is essentially that of protectionism, because it is essentially a matter of sharing out the privileges and perks and protection rackets of the state. And if you have that attitude to politics, and I think, you know, loops back to what we were talking about in corruption and the Fifth Republic last, in our last broadcast, if you have that situation, that encourages you to have protectionism, because it increases, you know, if you think of the state as a protection racket, and from that protection racket you are going to get benefit. Now, you can devise that in several different ways. You can either have benefit directly into your pocket or into the pocket of some asset you've taken control of, or you can have it because you are running or part of a group or institution that benefits particularly from the state. Now, it's, you know, no country is free of that in any part, but there are some countries that are more prone to that than others. So shall we say that level of corruption is much more endemic in France than in Denmark? Mm-hmm. It's much more endemic in Italy than in Norway. So I don't mean by that there's no corruption in Denmark or Norway, but I just mean that these are different notions of public community, public wealth, public responsibility. And protectionism, I would argue, is part of that, because what protectionism is essentially saying to somebody, you might wish to buy that for what is its, you know, international market rate. You cannot, because we have decided that you have to buy product X. Now, what a surprise. Product X is produced by such and such an employer or such and such a trade union, which backs us as a political party. What a surprise. So, you know, you get protectionism on the right, protectionism on the left. I mean, corruption is innocent of political labels. Mm-hmm. Discuss. Well, actually, it's rather funny. I can remember my father once saying to me, I mean, sort of glib remark that sometimes people make, but this remark was made to me about 55 years ago, so it's interesting what your mind remembers. He said to me, the interesting thing, he said, is that Tory scandals are all about sex and Labour scandals are all about money. Well, of course, that, he was talking to Britain, of course, that's not true. I mean, there were dodgy Tories on the money side. You can think of Magdalene or Duncan, for example, and there were dodgy Labour people on the sex side. But what he captured in that remark was that there was corruption across the political spectrum.
Well, talking about protectionism and tariffs leads me to seek a long view on French taxation. a long view doesn't have to be a long answer, but a long view on taxation. Has the focus been on tariffs rather than on taxes on income and property, at least until the wealth taxes of the Mitterrand years?
Well, I would be very wary about talking about long views. If you look back, on which there's been an enormous amount of very good work, excellent book by William Doyle on this, if you look back at the Ancien Régime, for example, you've got the issue such of the sale of offices. Now, I don't know how much you know about this, but a major way in which the state raised capital was to sell offices that, you know, appointments that were not necessarily brought with them any work, but which brought with them tax-exempt status. Those classically were a way to raise money from people who might not otherwise pay much tax. So how on earth weren't going to debate that? I mean, there's no modern equivalent to that, not that I'm aware of, though some clever listener, I'm a bit tired And the consortium says, we will offer you over the next 7 years 3 million livres, and we will then raise the tax. And the 3 million livres is a discount, but of course the state has the money to hand. Mm-hmm. So first of all, what that reveals is a world of shifts and expedients. And I think it's fair to say that the French money markets were considerably less sophisticated than their London counterparts, largely because there wasn't security of contract and there was the practice of arbitrary movements by the state in the seizure of assets, etc., etc. So what that meant was that the state found it harder to float its loans and had to resort much more to fiscal expediency. On top of that, in the 19th century, you have a pattern in which external customs duty is lower than its British equivalent because France isn't trading so extensively. So you have the issue, as with all governments in that period, of what timescale you're going to be planning your finances. Now, in essence, for the 19th century more positively, France is fortunate because, like most European states, its commitment to spending money on social economic welfare, social welfare, is very low. In the more modern period, you have, if you wish to use the overloaded term revolution, you have a revolution in expectations of welfare systems, which essentially date from the last 70 years, and if you wanted to politically locate it, you could say the state's trying to bribe the working class away from communism, and you could say you could attribute it to a sort of big nation conservatism in the form of the Gaullists and the form in many other European countries of Christian democracy, whatever you wanted to locate it for, and it's clearly that. And what that does is creates a dynamic of a need more recently for more money. And in the case of France, the easiest way to raise that money, other than borrowing it, of course, but the easiest way to raise it is through excise duties, what we would call value-added tax, because direct taxation, what we would call income tax, has a major problem of evasion and avoidance, whereas it's much harder to evade or avoid. It's possible in some areas, cigarette smuggling, for example, but it's harder to do that in excise duty terms. So I would say there are structural reasons about the issues of collection and also systemic factors coming arising from greater expenditure on social welfare that is pushing France into a more heavily taxed environment. And if you converse with French people, you will know, I mean, that one of the reasons they get very angry about government, their government, is that they fear and feel that not only are they heavily taxed, but that the state doesn't care.
Well, there's a lot of obviously regional pride and cultural difference from Paris, but I wonder how that finds its balance compared to the centralization of the French state. Should we always think of the French state, whether a republic or a monarchy, as highly centralized in European terms? Or is that actually not really the full picture, and there's much more department level autonomy around the regions of France than we perhaps give the country credit for?
Well, even centralised states rely on consent, and to a certain extent they derive their ability to administer or influence matters at a distance by having contrary agencies often competing with each other to send back reports to the centre, so the centre has some information that it can work on. I mean, remember, centralisation can be all very well, but if nobody pays any attention, you can send them as many instructions as you like. And, I mean, I used to say to my students, you need to think about France as a sort of, you know, think about you, Graham, as some great landlord of the 18th century, and I'm, some minister up in Paris, and I write to you and I say, you know, it's... His Majesty is proposing war, and we need from your that, you know, will focus on the instruction and the long live the king. But the reality of the politics of it is that the Intendant or whatever hasn't necessarily got any capacity to tell, you know, to necessarily nudge things. So, you know, there are problems there. I mean, even a dictator, a brutal dictator like Napoleon, faced a large-scale invasion of conscription. Napoleon I, I'm talking about there. So, you know, there are practical problems. There is an ungovernability in all countries and societies, whatever is the formal simulacrum of order and centralisation. You asked the specific question about regional identities. I mean, interestingly enough, the re-regionalisation of France, which has been one of the themes over the last half century, has in part been designed to break down regional identities by lumping together areas that don't necessarily see eye to eye. I mean, because in fact regionalism is a problem in France, but having said that, there is nothing to match the issue. Even, you know, you can go to Languedoc and people will talk to you about how badly they've been treated. You can go to Brittany or Corsica and they'll tell you even more, and with reason, that they've been badly treated. But there's no equivalent to the political dissent you'll find in Galicia or Andalusia, let alone Catalonia in Spain. There's been no equivalent to the Northern League in Italy, and there's no equivalent to, you know, the Scottish sort of blood and soil nationalists and their sort of Welsh would-be equivalents in the British Isles.
And, I mean, Corsica is, although part of France, is seen as very much its own affair, or does Corsica have any real influence on French political life?
Well, Corsica was bought off the Republic of Genoa in 1768. There was a rebellion against it from within Corsica that was suppressed in 1769. There was another rebellion again in the beginning of the 1790s that was suppressed in 1795. Thereafter, Corsica has been a poor part of the French state, dependent to a certain extent of subventions from the centre, with bandits, or whatever you want to call them. They would see themselves in a slightly different light, running most of the in the interior, and sort of provincial government in Bastia and Ajaccio, sending in, from the 1930s, you would send military sort of campaigns into the interior to try and bring it in, as if it was talking about the, you know, the Rif in Morocco, Rif Mountains in Morocco. I would say that, you know, there has been terrorism there more recently, as you know, but I would say that the reality is that Corsica is so divided within itself that it doesn't have the wherewithal to sustain a significant independence movement. On top of that, independence movements, as with, you know, the Eastern Europe and American money and the IRA, do depend often on international subvention. So the trouble the French had in their Basque country are related in large part to the more serious trouble that the Spaniards had in their Basque country. There isn't any, you know, the Italians aren't going to spend their time trying to stir up difficulties. Incidentally, the Italians did, of course, in the 30s, as you may know, one of the more amusing aspects. I mean, Mussolini was a ghastly man and his politics were ridiculous. But, you know, it's always, there's always fun to be had. I mean, Mussolini, of course, backed the idea of the Greater Italy and separatists in places like Malta against the British, Corsica against the French, etc., etc. But the reality was, and indeed, the French in 1944, 1945, at the end of Corsica's World War II, kicked out the Italians. It was pretty brutal stuff. But there's no suggestion of an Italian revanchism there.
Well, as we draw to a close, I want to bring in contemporary politics and the France of Emmanuel Macron. The combination of Macron being elected as a moderniser new ways of doing things, new party even, along with his very clear kind of bureaucratic Europeanism, but at the same time confronting all sorts of problems of which, you know, the Yellow Vest riots are just one of the more apparent manifestations. Do you get to pop into French for a moment? Do you get a sense of déjà vu when you think of the Macron years, or is France in a phase of political life which is actually distinct from previous decades, certainly in the last 50, 60 years?
Well, again, I mean, it's interesting. It depends where you put the emphasis. The last, I was due to go to France last year, but someone told there's some bugger going around, so it stopped me. But the previous year, I mean, my last day in France, last 3 days, were in Toulouse, and I remember on the last day, there was some big demonstration by the Yellow Vests going on, and riot police, and the, you know, road shut, and sort of people firing tear gas. And you walk round the corner, and there were people sitting down quite happily at cafes and restaurants, just getting on with their life. So partly, as so often, it depends upon which agenda you look at. The BBC would no doubt comment on the first, and you would get the impression, if you were, you know, that if you looked at the BBC, you'd get a very strange view of Britain. So again, I think the same thing is true of France. I mean, Macron is bitterly unpopular with a lot of people. His Jupiter complex isn't liked. He's seen as dishonest on the left. He's seen as unreliable on the right. But he's brilliantly lucky in his opposition, isn't he? And so much about politics is being lucky in your opposition. I mean, you know, President Trump was very lucky when he ran in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, whereas conversely, Joe Biden was very lucky in 2020 when he ran against Donald Trump. So, I mean, a lot of it depends upon whom you run against. And, I mean, what in effect has happened has been that the traditional left and the traditional right, the Republicans are the traditional, the successors of the Gaullists, and obviously you've still got the socialists on the left, they've both been hollowed out. And in a sense, it's to Macron's advantage, just as it was to Mitterrand's advantage, to try and see the far right as powerful and to say, if it's not me, it's them. And indeed, as I mentioned last time, given that choice, most French people would not wish the far right to come in. Mm-hmm. But what is interesting is the width of support for opposition to President Macron, and the extent to which it does indicate a dissatisfaction in terms of both the content and the symbolism of politics. He's clearly an able man. He clearly has a strong sense of his own significance. Well, that's normal in politicians. He has the prerogatives and power of being president, and France is a more monarchical system. And if he is unpopular, he won't be the first of France's rulers to be unpopular, but still to reign. And I mean, he's been very lucky. Chancellor Merkel, who had some capacity to stand up to him, has been replaced, being replaced as party leader by a complete make-weight who's clearly very francophile. And as long as Macron can dominate German politics and can be, you know, potent at the European Commission, he will go on with his idea of himself as a great world statesman. I'm not sure that message necessarily is being as well received or as clearly received as he would like in Washington, Beijing or Moscow.
Well, a final question, if I may put to you. We're now into France's Fifth Republic, and it's an impossible question to answer in the sense that, you know, it depends what you determine as success. But which of the five republics do you think have been the most successful?
Well, all the previous ones ended, so they weren't successful in those terms. But, you know, I would say the fifth and the third are the most successful for different reasons. I mean, the third ultimately succumbs national disaster in 1940, but it's worth bearing in mind that between 1939 and 1945, many political systems in the world succumbed to disaster. Prior to that, the Third Republic had kept going, which is a not unimportant thing. It was running the second largest empire in the world, which again is not insignificant, and it was presiding over a period of greater prosperity, and had within limits, and there was obviously it was running a complex, and as we know in the 1930s, controverted political system, but within limits, had a sense of confidence in its purpose, in the idea of France as a civilising force, etc., etc., etc. Whether the dynamic of that was seen as liberal or whether the dynamic of that was seen as Catholic, and there were different visions on offer. Now, obviously, the First Republic was a disaster. The Second Republic was very short-lived. The Fourth Republic was also short-lived. You come to the Fifth Republic. I mean, the Fifth Republic has this enormous boost at the start that it benefits from its section of the long boom. It benefits from the ability to get rid of the rest of empire, without great difficulties, unlike the Fourth Republic. It benefits from essentially setting up a European Union in its own image and which it dominates. So all of those are very powerful pluses. But I think it's fair to say that, you look at the public opinion polls, you speak to French people, many of the French today are uncertain. And we're not just talking about people on the left and the far right, or the far left, or whatever you want to call them. Or the right, whatever you want to call them. Many people are uncertain. They feel that they don't know where they are in their country. They don't feel that the government necessarily represents their interests. They don't necessarily like any of the other political groupings. All of these are factors that indicate a malaise. And as you know, many of the indicators of malaise are quite widely seen in France, from high rates of taking of antidepressants, etc., etc. And there's these other issues which we see in other countries as well. The question of whether large-scale immigration has led to a large group who reject the values of society and won't or can't be integrated, or whether those are just simply the noisier fringe. Those sort of questions are significant questions. I think the Fifth Republic is, and I wish it well. I mean, it's important for Britain that it succeeds, because although there are French politicians that would like to see Britain collapse, that would like to see Scotland independence and all the rest of it, it's not in our interest to have an unstable state on the other side of the channel, however the line it might be. I think it's fair to say that the Fifth Republic has provided its citizens with more peace than they knew under the Fourth, and more stability than they knew under the Fourth, but not necessarily with a government system that is one of probity, or a society that is necessarily open to talent, free and enterprising.
Well, on that judgment, we must leave it there, but it's been a fascinating journey through French history over the last few weeks. Professor Jeremy Black, whose book France, A Short History, is published in April, thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you, and listeners may be interested to know that Graham and I are thinking of doing the same on Germany.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.